Good morning. We start with a question this morning. If you knew that you were going to live till the end of this message, so you got about 30 more minutes, and that before your life ended in the next 30 minutes, that God was actually going to summarize where you are right now. Now, since your life is ending in 30 minutes, it's not where you hope to be or where you're going to start working on or where you're going to get to, but where you are right now. Not where you've been, but if he was going to put your life into words, where you are right now in your relationship with him, and then he was going to take his finger and write that summary right up there on the wall for everybody in here to see. Just put a couple sentences that describe right where you are with him right now. What would he write up there? Thinking about that? You're going to want, let me keep talking, let you off the hook, right? No, you guys think about that, okay? While you're thinking about that, we're in Daniel chapter 5 today, and in a very, very famous passage in Daniel, some of you probably figured out where it is, but before we dive into Daniel, as you guys are thinking about that, because you're going to have about 30 minutes to ponder that question, I was doing some research for a message that I was speaking on down at the University of Texas on the whole topic of Christianity and violence, and just the whole debate about the role of Christianity and violence in history and in the world. In the process of doing that, I was doing some research, and I came across a book by Rodney Stark, professor at Baylor University. He's a sociologist. The title of the book is For the Glory of God, and it's How Monotheism Led to Reformations, Science, Witch Hunts, and the End of Slavery. And so as I'm reading through this book, I get to the section on the rise of science in history, and his particular view is that Christianity and the church was the primary promoter of science. And that's why in the West we have science. The rest of the world we don't have science because of the church's commitment to study this concept called the heavens are declaring the glory of God, so let's study the heavens because we'll find God there. Anyway, he starts this chapter, and in the first sentence he says, even children know that in 1492 Christopher Columbus proved that the world is round. That's what I was taught, and that's what I believed. How many of you guys were taught that, and that's what you believed? That the majority of the people at the time of Christopher Columbus believed that the world was flat. You were taught that, right? You're fixing to be as ticked off as I was when I read this. I consider myself an educated person. I've got 4 years of college. I've got about 5.5 years of graduate education. I study history. I study sociology. Got a daughter that's majoring in history in the university. How could I not know what really was going on in 1492? Listen. They also know that he doggedly pursued backing for his voyage despite years of opposition from the Roman Catholic Church, which ridiculed all dissent from the biblical teaching that the earth is flat. Andrew Dixon White, 1832 to 1918, founder and first president of Cornell University, and the author of the single most influential book ever written on the conflict between science and theology, offered this summary. And here's what A.D. White wrote. The warfare of Columbus with religion, the world knows well. How the Bishop of Sintra worsted him in Portugal, how the sundry wise men of Spain confronted him with the usual quotations from Psalms, from St. Paul, and from St. Augustine, how even after he was triumphant, after his voyage had greatly strengthened the theory of the earth's sphericity, the church, by its highest authority, solemnly stumbled and persisted in going astray.
The theological barriers to this geographical truth yielded, but slowly. Plain as it had become to scholars, they hesitated to declare the world at large. But in 1519, science gains a crushing victory. Magellan makes his famous voyage. He proves the earth to be round, for his expedition circumnavigated it, yet even this does not end the war. Many conscientious religious men opposed the doctrine for 200 years longer. President of Cornell University wrote those words. Stark says, like everyone else, I grew up with this story. It was retold in every account of Columbus' voyage in my school books, in many movies, and always on Columbus Day. As for A.D. White's immense study, a history of the warfare of science with theology in Christendom in two volumes, when I was young, it was required reading for all budding intellectuals, and I cited it in my second published paper. The trouble is that almost every word of White's account of Columbus is a lie. Every educated person of the time, including the Roman Catholic prelates, knew that the earth was round. He made that up. And you were taught that, and so was I. And we believed it. And so I thought, well, that can't be true. Like, how could all these people get this wrong? And so I thought, well, you know, I just need to do a little bit of future study. I want to see how popular this concept is. And so I wikied it. Which you can do this afternoon. And if you go to Christopher Columbus and wiki it, you'll find out that today, historians will tell you that everybody believed that the earth was round in Christopher Columbus's day. The flat earth myth, actually there's a wiki on the flat earth myth and where it came from and why it was made up and why it's been propagated all these years. And the bottom line was, in the late 1800s, as Darwinism and science was making its emergence and it was being opposed by the church, there was a whole group of sociologists who created this pseudo-concept called the Dark Ages to show that the church has always been opposed to truth, to scientific discovery, and the like. What's interesting now is if you read your kids' textbooks, you'll find no mention of this flat earth concept because it's so clearly not what anybody believed back then. And I tell you that to do two things. First of all, to make you mad. Because I don't want to be mad alone. It's amazing to me. In 1945, the British Historical Society listed the flat earth myth as second on its list of the top 10 myths in history, and I went to school and learned it in the early 60s. How can that be? How can that be? Is there maybe the possibility that there are some people out there that would prefer to make your faith seem stupid and the people who believe your faith to seem stupid, to, in some way, shape, or form, make you feel less confident in what you believe? Now, I say all this just as a preamble to this particular passage because the first two words of this passage have been used to disprove that the book of Daniel has any reliability. The first two words are King Belshazzar. You say, well, what's that got to do with anything? Well, first of all, hey, let's face it, okay, if you're a non-believer, the stories that we've been studying in the book of Daniel seem a little far-fetched, right? I mean, this is pretty wild, okay? It is pretty wild. The whole, you know, all the stuff that's taking place in the dreams and, you know, the whole delivering these guys from the fiery furnace and all that, it seems a little far-fetched. The handwriting on the wall, which we're going to look at, seems a little far-fetched. And here's what was being said during that same period of time when the Christopher Columbus flat earth myth was being made up. They were saying, well, we don't have any historical record of a King Belshazzar. The last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. And therefore, since we don't have any evidence, see, the story about Daniel was simply made up because this is not accurate in the historical record, which is why I love archaeology. Because if you keep digging long enough, you're going to find stuff. And you know what they found? They found a detailed account of the fall of Babylon. In addition to that, we have 37 actual records during the reign of Nabonidus saying that he had a son named Belshazzar, and Belshazzar was a co-regent. He ruled with his father because his father was a little weird and didn't like to live in Babylon. So Belshazzar basically was the one who lived in Babylon and ruled from Babylon. But here's the deal. If you were trained by somebody who went to college and learned this stuff in the late 20s and were teaching in the 50s and 60s, they would have taught you. See, the Bible is full of baloney because it makes up these names of people like Belshazzar who never really existed, and that would have been taught long after archaeology had discovered the name and proved the historicity of the story. Now, I could spend about 2.5 hours with you guys this morning walking you through. Yeah, somebody's hungry. I can spend about 2.5 hours with you this morning walking you through the historicity of the story down to the details. Let me just say, if you want to read it, do some research, do some reading on your own. There's plenty of stuff out there available with the internet. But the bottom line is the details of this story parallel exactly what happened in history. We even know the day and time in history when this happened. We know those details. They parallel the story perfectly. So, once again, don't believe everything you've been taught, particularly when it's for the purpose of disproving your faith. Having said all that, this is a phenomenal story. So let's look at it together. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. They brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives, and concubines drank from them. And as they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Now, they're having a party. This party's fixing to get interrupted, but before it gets interrupted, let me just say from a historical standpoint, the thing you might not be aware of is that while they're having this party, the Persian army has the city of Babylon surrounded. Nabonidus, the father of Belshazzar, has just suffered a crushing defeat by the hands of the armies of the Persians and Medes who had joined together, and essentially the only ground left standing under Babylonian control was the city of Babylon itself. Seems like a strange time to have a party. But they are having a party. And they're having a party partially because they're confident that their city will never fall. As we described last week, the walls of Babylon surrounded the city were so thick, so large, and it was such an impenetrable city that nobody ever believed that Babylon could be taken. In addition to that, the Euphrates River ran through the city, running underneath the walls, which allowed water source to be in the city, so no matter how long the siege was, they would always have water. And in addition to that, one of the historians from the 5th century, one of the Greek historians, said that they had several years' supply of food to feed everybody in the city, and so it appeared that Belshazzar was safe within his city. So they're having a party. They're drinking. They're enjoying themselves. They got the wives, the concubines, the nobles together. And in the middle of that, Belshazzar says, aha, we need more cups. What about those cups that were used in the temple worship back in Jerusalem? And he did something that even polytheists wouldn't do, to desecrate the sacred utensils from another god. And that's what he chose to do. So, while he's partying, Verse 5, suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale. He was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. As this hand begins to etch on the wall words in the plaster next to the lamplight so everybody could see it in this huge hall in the royal palace, about 10,000 square foot room that was filled with all of these people partying, and everybody sees this being written on the wall, and he is freaking out. Like his knees are knocking together. Now, I'm sure with the Persians on the outside, there's a little bit of like, we're having fun in here, but oh, there's something bad out there. But now, something more sinister, more divine, has taken place on the inside. And so he gets all upset. And in verse 7, it says, the king called out. The phrase called out there in the Aramaic is he called out with strength. In other words, he starts yelling. He starts screaming for the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners to be brought and said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made third highest ruler in the kingdom. Number one, Papa Nabonidus. Number two, Belshazzar. Number three, whoever can read this gets a promotion. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified. His face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, hearing the voices of the king, now that's a lot of noise. She's hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. Now, the queen here appears to be the queen mother. All of Belshazzar's wives and concubines are actually at the party. So this is the queen mother who comes in. Now, we're not sure exactly the relationships between all these people. King Nebuchadnezzar actually was not the father of Nabonidus. Nabonidus was one of his rulers in his court, and after a couple of his descendants died and were executed from bad kind of stuff, Nabonidus assumed the throne, and his son Belshazzar is he's his second there in Babylon. We're not exactly sure what the relationship is, but it may be that Belshazzar is actually a blood relative of Nebuchadnezzar. He's called his son, which in ancient times would simply mean his successor, but he actually could have been a relative. Frequently, in the case of the king, Nabonidus would take one of the king's daughters and marry her to solidify his kingdom. So it may be that Nebuchadnezzar's daughter is the queen mother here, married to Nabonidus, and she's actually the mother of Belshazzar. Anyway, she represents the old group, and she hears all this commotion, and so she comes in, and she's got some advice on how to deal with this situation. The queen says, O king, live forever. She says, don't be alarmed, don't look so pale. There is a man in the kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, I say, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. This man Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means. So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? I've heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have an insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I've heard that you are able to give interpretations to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made third highest ruler in the kingdom. Now, it's been 23 years since the death of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel is about 80 years of age at this time. So he's kind of grown up, lived his life. He's been probably put into retirement because you got new kings, young blood, young wisdom. But Daniel's being brought in to interpret the dream. So the party is interrupted by the handwriting on the wall. And now Daniel is going to interpret the dream. So watch what happens. When Daniel begins to talk, then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else." Now, that could be the words of an 80-year-old who's just a little cranky from being called to a party at that time of night, or it could show you Daniel's disdain for this young king and his lack of wisdom. "Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means." He says, "O king, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples and nations and men of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. Those he wanted to humble, he humbled." What's he saying? He's saying, listen, Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar was a real king. He was a great king. You don't hold a candle to his greatness. Your kingdom and your reign is a joke in compared to how awesome Nebuchadnezzar was. I laugh at your insignificance in the face of the greatness of the man I served under. You're just a peon here. He was great. Do you remember what happened to him? Daniel says, "But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys, ate grass with the cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and sets over them anyone he wishes." Now, for those of you who missed last week, you might not know what this is all about. You need to get online, get one of the tapes, figure it out. Anyway, bottom line is in his pride, Nebuchadnezzar was brought down to a place where he was insane. He was brought down from the throne to the existence of an animal. Implied, what do you think the God of heaven is going to do to your lowly carcass, Belshazzar? You are toast. "But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself. You knew all this." We have records that indicate, independent records of the Bible that indicate that Belshazzar was actually a high official, held a rule or a post in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom when he was a young man. And so he would have actually seen Nebuchadnezzar come off the throne. He would have seen him humbled, and he would have heard about that. That would have been part of what he heard about. Remember, we got people in the 3rd century and in the 2nd century that are still writing about Nebuchadnezzar's illness, and this is taking place back in the 500s. So this was a well-known thing. He saw it. He says, Nebuchadnezzar messed up, God humbled him, and you knew this. "Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, you and your nobles. Your wives and your concubines drank from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways." Those two phrases are extremely important. That phrase, the God who holds in your hand your life, literally is the word that means breath. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, it says, "The Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground, and he breathed into his nostrils, thus raising the face of man up to the face of God, and he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being." Now, when does man stop being a living being and start being dirt again? It's when he stops breathing, right? Here's what he's saying. He's saying the God of heaven, who actually is in charge of the very breath that fills your lungs, that animates your life. Stop breathing for 60 seconds and see what happens to you. The God of heaven who controls your next heartbeat, in other words, your very life, is under his sovereign control. And he says, the God who's in charge of your way or your path, or the word literally means your circumstances. In other words, the God who controls what happens to you during the course of the day, the God who controls what happens to you during the course of a year, who deals with the people and circumstance around you. He says, you are worshiping the gods of gold and silver, stone, stuff, the creation, and ignoring the God who actually gives you the very life that you're enjoying while you're worshiping that junk. I don't know about you guys, but this is extremely convicting to me. This is extremely convicting. As I was working through this passage, I thought, how many days do I go through? And I'm all focused on the creation. Like, you know, what am I driving? Where do I live? What am I getting? How am I going to pay the bills? I'm all focused on, am I going to have a good day? Is it going to be fun? Is it going to be enjoyable? Am I going to get my way? Am I going to get to do what I want to do? Are people going to pay attention to me? Are they going to give me the respect that I deserve? Because obviously, you know, I'm like Belshazzar, one of those really important people. And I'm thinking about the stuff of this creation and ignoring the one who controls whether I will actually draw another breath, whether my heart will beat again, whether my life will end by the time we get done with this message. He also controls what's going to happen to me, the circumstances that surround my life. And I'm focused on the stuff, my life. I worry about the stuff in my life. I'm not the one who is the source of my existence. Well, Daniel goes on to say, let me just tell you what he has to say about you. Belshazzar, here's what he wrote about you up here on the wall. He says, this is the inscription that was written, Mene, Mene, Tikal, Pharsin. These are Aramaic words that were written, Mene, Mene, four words, Mene, Mene, or excuse me, three words. Mene is repeated twice for emphasis to get the thing started. And he says, this is what it means. Mene, the word is the Aramaic word which means to number. And he says, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. He's counted up how long you're going to reign, how many days you're going to live, and it's over. You're dead. It's over. You're done. I think it's interesting. God gave Nebuchadnezzar 12 months to repent. It looks like, as best I can figure the timing of this, he's going to give Belshazzar about 2 more hours to breathe, and then he's done. It's over. Tikal, the word is the Aramaic word which means to weigh, like to weigh on a scale. You have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. When God puts your life on the scale and he measures your life, the value of what you bring to the table versus what he created you to do and be, you come up short. Your life is not worth keeping. Finally, Phares, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Phares literally means divide. It's the Aramaic word which means divide. What's interesting here is the three consonants of this word, which when the writing would have gone up on the wall, they'd leave the vowels out. The consonants were all that was written. They're the exact same consonants that you find in the word Persian. Persian. He says, listen, your kingdom is divided. That literally means it's dissolved. It's gone. And it's been given to the Medes and the Persians. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple. A gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. The corroborating evidence from historical sources tell us that the way the Persian army actually entered the city, and they actually entered the city the night that this party was going on, What they did was they began to try to dig channels to divert the Euphrates River into a swampland, and as they diverted the river and the flow of the river went down, it allowed the Persian troops to march actually literally into the city in the riverbed underneath, and there were no Babylonians prepared for that. So there was no army waiting for them. One historical account says that they searched the city till they got to the royal palace. They went into the royal palace where Belshazzar had a dagger in his hand, probably to take his own life, and they were able to wrestle the dagger away from him and execute him there in the palace where he gave up his life. Now here's the thing that's just phenomenal to me. Daniel is the kid from Israel that is carried away into captivity in chains, taken and put in this pagan place. And at 14 years of age, he thinks, God has lost control of the world. I am now under the rulership of Nebuchadnezzar. And over the course of his life, he lives in Babylon under this world empire. But you know how the story of Babylon ends? Number one in the kingdom, Nabonidus, is running for his life, fleeing the Persians who are going to kill him. Number two in the kingdom, the next guy in line, Belshazzar, dies that night. Who's number three in the kingdom? Daniel's now wearing the purple robe and the gold chain. He's number three in the kingdom. In some strange way, Daniel kind of ends up as the last emperor in the empire that was designed to carry the people into captivity. He doesn't want it. Who wants to be king of nothing? And that's the point of the book. Who wants to own it all? Who wants to be in charge of everything here? Who wants to be at the top of everything here when everything here is just small potatoes compared to the kingdom of God and the glory of God? And yet we fight for it. We wrestle for it. We live for it. We strive for it. And what does it mean at the end of the day? Three questions we want to look at as we wrap up here. The first question is this: how do the rebellious tendencies of your heart manifest themselves? It would be very arrogant of us as people to look at Nebuchadnezzar and look at Belshazzar and say, yeah, those guys are kind of unusual. They were rebellious. They were prideful. They kind of lived in this world of themselves, and not recognize that we have the same tendency to do that. We have the same tendency to do that. So for you, what are those rebellious tendencies? Where do you see yourself when God pushes into your life, you find yourself pushing back against him? You know, Scripture makes it very, very clear that our sin nature is something that we inherited from Adam, and then we joyfully participate in it. In Romans chapter 5, verse 12, it says, therefore, as by one man, talking about Adam, sin entered into the world, and death because of sin, and so death passed to all of us because all of us have sinned. And then Paul goes on in Romans chapter 7 to tell us this unique thing, and that unique thing is that whenever we're confronted with God's law, the law actually works in concert with our sin nature to make us even more rebellious. He said, you know, when I didn't know that covetousness was in the law, I didn't know that it was in the law, I didn't think that much about whatever other people had. But the moment I found out, thou shalt not covet, then I started looking around at what everything everybody else had, and I started coveting everything. That's the rebellious tendency of our heart. Tell me what I can't do, and all of a sudden, I want to do it. You want to try an experiment? Those of you who have teenagers? Just make a list of rules of the things that your kids haven't wanted to do yet. And tell them, you know, here are the rules of the things that you can't do. Well, the first reaction you're going to get is, well, I don't want to do that. And the next reaction you're going to get is, well, why can't I do that? Never thought about it before, but now that you mention it, that's the rebellious tendency of the heart. And all of us are affected in different ways. For you, When you think about your pushback against God's intervention in your life, where does that come from? What is it for you? Second question is, whose life story warns and challenges you, your understanding of God? Whose life story warns and challenges you of your understanding of God? Belshazzar had Nebuchadnezzar. He saw his life, and he saw his story. He saw how God intervened in it, and he ignored it. And he went on his way, and he was not informed. When you look around at the examples in your life, do you see people who didn't follow God's plan, who didn't bow the knee to God, who pursued a course, and you see the result of their life, and yet you still follow it? You still emulate them. You still go down that path. Why do we do that? Is there someone in your life like that? Let me just speak to our young people here. I mean, a lot of you guys, you take a look at mom and dad, and you see a lot of hypocrisy. I mean, you live with them, you're going to see. You know, the words come out of the mouth, but then the behavior doesn't measure up, and you see that? That's just normal. Hey, your mom and dad are depraved. They're flawed, just like me, just like all of us. We need Jesus, we need grace, but we don't act like it, do we? We act like we got it all together. But you look at that. When you look at the failings of your parents, do you use that as an excuse to say, well, since mom and dad don't have this faith thing right, then why should I be expected to have this faith thing right? So you use that excuse to move further away from God rather than to say, you know, my mom and dad don't have this thing right, and look at the pain that that brings into their life. Look at the confusion there. Look at the arrogance there. That means I need to lean deeper into my relationship with God rather than pull back. You see, a lot of times we look at other people and God's giving us warnings. He's challenging us. What do you do with those examples? Finally, if God wrote your story on the wall today, what would he write? That's the question we started with. If he wrote your story on the wall today, what would he write? Numbered, weighed, divided. Numbered, weighed, divided. What would he say about you? I know when it comes to the numbered thing, every one of us assumes that we've got unlimited life. We just assume that. I mean, I'm 49 years old, and I think I'm just getting started. Like, there's got to be a lot more time, because I got a lot of makeup work to do, you know? I need a lot of time, because I got a lot of makeup work to do. That's kind of what I think. This weekend, I was privileged to be part of a memorial service for a young man that grew up at Hill Country Bible Church. A junior at UT, got to do his dream job this summer. Liked by everybody. Everybody liked him. And earlier in the semester, started feeling bad, got a case of mono, feeling really bad, let's go to the hospital, walked into the hospital, collapsed. 11 weeks later in ICU at MD Anderson, on Thanksgiving morning, he took his last breath. Nobody in the world would have ever thought that his life would end at age 21. There's no reason for that. It doesn't make any sense. Like, nobody could have expected that. But you know what? Life will come to an end because our days are numbered. Wade, the way you're living today, what you're doing with your life right now, being weighed in the balance. Would God be able to say, your life has significant value because what you're doing with it, what you're doing with it, right now, that reflects why I created you, why I put you here. You know, oftentimes we think, well, it doesn't right now, but it will. You know, I'm going to get there. I'm moving in that direction. Don't deceive yourself with that. Here's what you need to understand. Here's what I need to understand. We need to embrace the fact that really, 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 right now, the way I'm living right now is who I am and who I'm going to be. What I'm going to choose to do in this day will influence who I am tomorrow, which will influence who I am the next day, which means that what I decide today and what I do today is of extreme importance. Can't put it off. Divided. Someday I'm going to come to the end. And will what I did with this life really mean anything significant for eternity? God bless you if you're 12, 13 years old and you're asking those kind of questions. Better than to be 32, but it's better to do it at 32 than it is to do it at 62. It's better to do it at 62 than it is to do it at 82. And it's better to do it at 82 than it is to do it after life is over and you stand before the judgment seat of Christ and you say, what was I thinking? What was I thinking? What was I thinking? Do you worship the idols of gold and silver, of wood and stone, of iron? Or the God who gives you your breath and controls the circumstances of your life? Let's bow our heads for prayer.